what? What is the purpose of the heart? Why did God give it? We talked last week about how the sacrifices are not what God wants, and he never did. Even if I command you to do them, it ain't what I want.
And it was all constructed so he could dwell with his people.
It was all constructed so he could dwell with his people, but he could have dwelled with his people without the temple. And he could dwell with us without that temple. Is it any different? Did that change at the cross? Could he not have dwelt with the people before the cross? And the answer is, if you look throughout the Testament, Old Testament, he says, look, I can write my law in your heart and your mind back then, just the same as he does today. So the temple, the tabernacle, wasn't a necessary part for God to interact with humanity.
Steve? When Moses went up on the mountain and he came down and was talking to them, the people asked for there to be a veil put over his face because he was too bright. They wanted some distance between them and God. Do you think the tabernacle and the temples are God's accommodation for that human request for distance?
No.
I do. I'm with you, Anna. I think it's not necessary for God on God's part, but it's necessary on our part. We don't change our opinions very easily. It's slow and gradual, and God recognizes that and accommodates us. We picked this way as an illustration. Paul in Colossians says the reality of the temple is Jesus Christ. Paul says it's the mystery of God revealed in Jesus. The temple is a shadow of the reality of the mysteries of God.
I agree with all that.
As evidenced in Jesus Christ. So even at Paul's time, there's still mysteries to God that he doesn't understand. And why not? Is it a limitation of God that Paul can't understand, or is it a limitation of Paul? Is it a limitation of God that he couldn't communicate with the Israelites very well, or is it a limitation of the Israelites?
I'm of the belief that God can communicate and reveal himself to anybody who's willing to listen. I don't think it's a limitation of humanity in the sense that we can't. I think God has the ability to work within us and make us understand it. That's what he chooses to do, and if we're willing to accept. Let me tell you where I want to go as an endpoint, and then we can see if we can get there. I believe that the sacrificial system, the temple, began at Exodus, and at the cross, it said, okay, now all the things that we've been learning from the sacrificial system, now we're doing them with real things instead of with representative things. In other words, Jesus dying on the cross was not the end of what the temple tried to show. It was the beginning. Right now, most of us, from the pulpit, you will hear, Jesus died on the cross. It's all over. In fact, Paul even says this, basically. At the cross, all of that's done. We can throw it away. And I argue instead, that's where it begins. Jesus dies on the cross. That is step one of the plan of salvation. The person who wrote the law, the God who wrote the law, has to be the one who dies in order to allow anybody else to live. But that's where it begins. It's not where it ends. So go back and take a look at the temple system. I sin. What's the first thing I'm supposed to do when I sin? Back at the time of Exodus, the Jews. They take a lamb, a dove, a goat, and they bring it to the what? They bring it to the entrance of the temple. What do?
First, it has to be approved by the priest. Then they slit its throat.
And then they kill it. They slit its throat, drain it of its blood. Where does that happen?
Courtyard.
And then the next step is the altar of sacrifice. My question is, which part of the temple system is the cross representing? Or the other way around, which part of the temple system represents what's going to happen on the cross? Isn't it that first step where the animal is sacrificed and then offered on the altar of burnt offering, the sacrificial altar?
I think so.
That's step one.
I think it's when the priest takes the blood and takes it to the altar inside the temple.
You're right. That is step two. So as soon as the lamb is slaughtered, dove, goat, whatever it might be, bull, the blood is then carried inside of the temple, and it is taken to the altar of incense and flicked upon the horns of that altar and before the curtain that separates the holy place, most holy place. Is that correct? That happens after the cross. True or false?
True.
True. Anybody challenge that? In other words, go ahead.
I don't think that the blood of the sin offerings of the lambs went to the altar of incense. I think they stayed on the altar of sacrifice.
Okay, you may be right. What blood was taken into the holy place?
It would have been the blood of the rams, the goats, and the bulls that went in there. I don't think anything of a sheep ever went inside the holy place.
Okay. You may be right. I don't know the answer.
And question. Anna,
Yes.
Were those animals defined by sins they represented?
No. They were more defined by who brought them and why they were brought.
Correct.
And I still have more research to do because it's been a while since I've looked at the detail. But something in my brain is telling me that it was maybe more corporate offerings or offerings on behalf of the priest and his family that went all the way to the altar of incense, and that most of the general people's offerings were on the altar of sacrifice. But I could be mistaken.
Is that the cross is the first step of the plan of salvation. It's not the end, it's not the final step, it's step one. Step two is the blood is taken from the cross, which we are equating to the altar of sacrifice or the entrance to the temple, to the entrance of the gate. Step two is the taking of some of that blood, whether it may be not a lamb, perhaps the bulls, etc. And that blood is taken into the holy place and sprinkled. What's the next step according to the sacrificial system? Him. He does. So Tim's correct that the priest washes his body, washes his hands, and washes himself with the laver, which is out there beside the altar of sacrifice. And that is a part of it. That also happens after the cross. The priest takes the blood into the holy place on a daily basis. There's also a number of things that are in the holy place. Mike's got his nice little fold out, which has the tabernacle reviewing it. He's got all of the showbread, lampstand, altar of incense, and then inside the most holy place veil. By the way, as a side note, how many veils are there? The temple, and not the tabernacle. How many veils were there for the Herod's temple, the second temple?
No idea.
There's more than one. There are multiple. So, just as a side note, that's the most excellent question. So, there are several veils in Herod's temple. In Herod's temple, according, this is not biblical, this is Josephus, who was a priest who happened to travel with the Roman army and became a historian, said that the veil between the most holy place and the holy place was two veils. And they were like this with a passageway in between them. Huge veils. Apparently there were two of them made each and every year. And they replaced one, they replaced it on the Day of Atonement every year. It took 300 priests to wash one of these curtains, one of these veils. It was made by either 82 young ladies or it was paid for with 82 something. It's unclear which way the translation was. There's a whole bunch more to it. But those are the ones which Josephus says. There's some other things about the width of the curtain, which is not Josephus either, even though he gets credit for it, etc. That's one of the veils. Maybe two, if you want to count those. The other veil, so on Herod's temple, there was a wealthy man in Alexandria, Egypt, who decided he was going to donate the doors to the entrance to the holy place. Not to the most holy place, but the entrance to the holy place. They are copper doors, which apparently somehow miraculously survived a boat journey and made it to Jerusalem. They were not covered in gold like all the other doors. Instead, they were copper. It took about 20 people to move that door. It was a big door. In front of that door was another veil. And it was a blue veil, according to Josephus, that had representations of the galaxies and the solar systems and the stars. It was beautiful, scarlet thread running throughout it, and it was a Babylonian tapestry. And it was depicted, according to some people, either the Milky Way or at least at minimum, stars that we see in the sky. Astrology. It represented and had on it, apparently, some of the astrological constellations that were popular in the Babylonian system. That hung in front of the entry to the holy place. There was yet another veil. In this veil, so in Herod's temple, in the second temple, the holy place was actually a multi-story building, 8 stories high. And there was a curtain that went from one of the upper floors going down through the first floor and provided yet another veil. The upper floors were used for multiple things, but one of them, there were holes in the floors which you could take a broom and wipe the walls of all the soot that had collected on the wall, without going actually into the holy place or the most holy place. Herod's temple was quite the place, quite different from the tabernacle. Much larger, much grander, except it was that temple in which the veil was torn. We don't know which veil was torn. We presume It was the veil between the holy place and the most holy place. We presume that it might have been both veils because there were two overlapping veils. We don't know. Doesn't say. We presume it was not the constellation tapestry out at the front. Presumption. Anyway, that's a side note. It's one of those rabbit holes you get stuck on. Start researching. The point being, I want to end up with the idea that the sacrificial system, the Mosaic law, etc., is a shadow. It's a sample. It's a pattern. It's a model of what starts with Jesus. Not what ends with Jesus, but what starts with Jesus. The challenge we have is when we say it ends with Jesus, is we then throw everything away.
Steve? Yeah. What do you do with the comment that he is the author and finisher of our faith then?
Well, Jesus, I mean, the end of it, when you study it through, it leads to Jesus.
I think Andy has the most excellent answer. It all starts and ends with Jesus. That's all that matters. At the same time, if that's all that mattered, if the cross was the only thing, if that's where it ended, then why are we still here 2,000 years later? It's a question we've asked before. Why didn't Jesus, when he died, was resurrected, met with the close apostles, family, friends, etc., he then shortly thereafter ascends to heaven. He then comes back, apparently, immediately. Why didn't he come with the angel armies of heaven? Why didn't he come within 30 days, 20 days, whatever the number you want to pick? Why didn't he come within the first month or two of his return to heaven? Why didn't he come back to earth with all of heaven in tow?
The gospel had not been spread in the world yet.
All right. So the idea is that the gospel has to be spread to the entire world, and then Jesus can come. Then he can, or then he will. There's a difference.
Is Steve?
Of the gospel a requirement prior to Jesus being able to return, or is the spreading of the gospel a statement of fact of what will happen before he returns? Anna, yeah.
My comment with Jesus being the author and finisher of our faith does not mean that the cross is the only event. I'm just saying that the focus of each of the parts would be Jesus and him doing something.
Yes, I will agree with that, and I will also extend it to include us as well. Here's why. I believe that the sacrificial system and the temple system, the Mosaic law, is there for the purpose of saying, look, Jesus dies on the cross. Jesus takes our sins upon him. Jesus intercedes on our behalf. Jesus goes before the Father, and he, Jesus himself, is the one who turns around and judges whether or not we are in harmony with Jesus. Every element of the sacrificial system, every element of the temple is Jesus. 100%, every single one of them. Table of showbread, altar of incense, smoke, lamps, walls, curtains, gates, all of it. Jesus says, I'm in all of those things. They all represent me. They are the mystery of God. But there's a part of us in there too. There are things that that entire sacrificial system says are about us. We are not just bystanders in this process. What is our role according to that system? When we say it ends at the cross, we are absolved of any responsibility and any action. That's what we lose when we say it ends at the cross. It begins at the cross. And we have a role to play in this as well. That's why that whole model is there. It's because it is there to teach us what our role is as well. It teaches us about God. It teaches us about Jesus. It teaches us how God is going to eradicate evil. And he says, I have a role for you as well. What is that role? What does that sacrificial system teach our role is?
He calls us to be priests.
He does do that.
We have to believe.
We do have to
believe. If we don't believe, we're already perishing.
Good quote. That is true. We have to believe. And when we believe, what do we do? As Anna says, we are called to be the priests, not just Jesus. We are called to be priests as well. And what is the priest's responsibility? At the time of the tabernacle, the priest had a lot of responsibilities. They dedicated approximately, you know, 1/12 of all the people in the land to being priests. They had a lot of duties. They were shepherds. Somebody raised a lot of sheep. There were flocks and flocks of Levitical priests who did nothing but shepherd work. And their job was to raise the sheep and the doves and the goats and bulls and the rams so that they could be brought in and part of that sacrificial system. The priest was responsible for cleaning the laver. There was another set of priests who were responsible for carrying the water. There was another set of priests who were responsible for making the oil. The way it typically turned out to be is during the time of David, he said, look, this whole system needs organized. So, Rivera family, you are responsible for making the incense that is going to be on the altar of incense. The Claus family, you are going to be responsible for slaughtering all of the sacrifices for the first 2 weeks in the beginning of the year. The Oakham family, you are responsible for slaughtering all the animals in the second 2 weeks of the year. That's your responsibility. And by the way, we have inside the courtyard, just beside the altar of burnt offering, beside the laver, we have a set of pillars and we have a set of hoops. There are 24 hoops. There are 24 pillars. And what is the purpose of those pillars and hoops? Because that is where they brought in the animal. So it's a sheep, they hung the sheep from the pillar. There were a couple of hooks right here. They could use it as their slaughtering block. And so for the first 2 weeks of the year, the Claus pillar is the one in which they're used. The second 2 weeks, the Yoakum family is going to be using this pillar. 24 pillars over the course of the year. And by the way, on the day of Passover and on the festival, when we bring everybody in, we're going to activate every one of the pillars and every one of them is going to be used. But during most of the year, this pillar is only used for that 2 week period. This pillar then is used for the next 2 week period. This pillar is used for the next 2 week period with a different family responsible for each one. And by the way, your family is going to be subdivided such that you're going to be making the altar of incense for us, and you're going to be responsible for making sure it's there every day, etc. By the way, we want that smoke to be such that it raises straight up, and we do not want it to spread out and become a diffuse smoke. And we want it to be a perfume. And by the way, only your family, for us to be eternity, is the only family that can make that incense. And it's a secret. And nobody else can know what the ingredients are. We'll tell you some of the ingredients, but not all of them, because there's a couple of important ingredients. And by the way, your family said, you know, they got a little uppity about it. And so the Sanhedrin got tired of the Rivera family making it, and they decided they were going to take it away and give it to the Parnell family. The Rivera, the Rivera family said, no. This is a secret. Only our family is allowed to do this for the rest of eternity. The Parnell family cannot do this. And there's a whole history about that in the Talmud, about how it became a very hereditary thing for millennia, of which families traced exactly who was who, etc. So out of these 24 pillars and hoops they used for the larger animals, there was one family which allowed one of their daughters to marry outside of the Levitical system. As a result, that hoop and that pillar were not allowed to be used. That entire family was excluded from the system until that was rectified. We take a look at all that. The point being, what is our role in that system? In other words, what was the purpose of knowing all of this stuff? Why was this model made? And how does it apply to us today, post-cross? It is about sacrifice, it's about obedience. And we left that last week. We are the sacrifice. Our pure hearts, our praise, our worship, our obedience to God is the sacrifice that God wants of us today. That's what he wanted then too. It didn't change us.
It's also about others, because as a priest, I don't have a ministry unless I am ministering on behalf of someone else.
So today, if I go to a Catholic church, the priest inserts himself in between me and God. Is that the way it's supposed to be?
In the Catholic Church.
In the ancient Jewish tradition.
And in ancient Jewish tradition. Could I approach God directly without a priest in the ancient Jewish tradition?
If you wanted to die.
I don't think so, because going up Mount Sinai, God said, don't even let the animals, plus the people, even get close to the mountain while that's happening.
So the question becomes then, did that change at the cross? Or is that still true, or was it never true? Tim?
It changed.
Did it?
I think it's changing.
We became priests, a priestly group, right?
Are we that priestly group now, or is that something that's going to happen?
Well, that appears to be one of the symbolic reasons why the veil was torn.
All right, so this is a question for Dana, based on what Ryan said. That's good. All right, so question for you, Dana. The veil was torn at the cross. Jesus dies, veil torn. According to Paul, where does Jesus go at that point? He now has access to what? So when the veil is torn, Jesus can now go on our behalf directly to the most holy place, correct?
The throne of God, yeah.
That's a question for David. Because I'm cruel. It did what? So Dana's saying, for those of you who can't hear, that the veil separated the most holy place. The veil was torn at the cross. Did Jesus have access to the most holy place at the cross? All right. Paul says that he did.
I question. The reason why I question that is because Christ himself said, I have to go and present myself to the Father. Mm-hmm. This is after the veil has been torn,
okay,
that my sacrifice would be approved.
So when did he make that presentation of himself to the Father? And has that happened, or is it going to happen? So I will give you several options. One, he tells the women, don't cling to me. If I get the phrasing correct, Dana. Don't cling to me because I haven't yet gone to my Father. He then immediately ascends to the Father and then returns to earth Did he get approval from his father at that point? And did he recognize it? Or is that an event that happens in the future?
Either. I think it happened shortly after the sacrifice.
So it happened within a few days, hours, whatever it may be, is appropriate. And then at that point in time, could he then enter the most holy place?
Absolutely.
Does this tie in with the 1844 event?
That's why I asked data, because I mean. Yes, that is the question. Adventism teaches that Christ does not enter the most holy place until 1844. Is that correct? Does it matter? Are we simply describing things that... Okay, Dana's ready to speak.
I think that with, as far as Christ and the ministry goes, that it did not get the most holy place until 1844. Doesn't mean he doesn't have access in there because of God, but his ministry.
So for those of you who couldn't hear, because Anna's quiet, way in the back and relatively soft-spoken, Dana's comment, correct me if I'm wrong, is that Jesus may have had access to the most holy place prior to, or at the cross, but his ministry in the most holy place did not begin until 1844. Is that fair? Okay. My point is this. What is our role in the sacrificial system? We talk about Jesus's role. We talk about the role of God. What does that sacrificial system say our role is? Is our role simply to bring the sacrifice and then we're done? Or is there more?
There must be more.
And what is the must be more?
There must be more because if the ancient Israelites had got it right, there would have been more than just the sacrifice. There would have been proclaiming God to the nations. They didn't get it right. So my argument is that, yeah, there should be more beyond the temple sacrifice.
Okay.
There's the evangelism to the world, to the nations, to let the world know about God's righteousness.
Got Tim and JC.
We're a living sacrifice.
We are a living sacrifice.
Stole right out of your mouth, Lee. Last time I raised my hand after you, Tim. We are the sacrifice.
We are the sacrifice.
And I think Christ is going to come when that living sacrifice is a practical reality.
So I'm going to take your words and twist them and correct me if I'm being...
Please.
Can Christ come unless a certain number of people are that proper sacrifice, until all of us are? In other words, is God's return conditional upon a group of people becoming that fulfilled sacrifice? Or is God going to come at a certain time regardless of whether or not we're ready, unless whether we are the proper sacrifice? Is it conditional upon our action, or is our actions regarded irrelevant?
I can't speak for God. I can't answer that question. All I know is for there to be a rising of God in my reality, in my influence, in my life. I have to live that sacrifice.
So I got a question. The masks. How many people in the world do not know that you should probably wear a mask right now? Some tribe in New Guinea, maybe? Some of the Amazonian tribes maybe don't know about the mask?
Well, they got dropped.
We dropped masks into them, did we? They got the message?
That's probably what made them sick.
In other words, is there anybody, so take a look, how long did it take for the world to get the message about masks? Is there anybody out there that doesn't know? Is God's return conditional upon everybody knowing about the mask? I'm using the analogy of mask being the gospel. Is God's return conditional upon everybody knowing that they need to wear a mask?
Some people might think so.
And yet that's what some of us teach. So when we say that God can't return until the masks get to the whole world.
Well, how about the opportunity to know?
Okay. Does everybody have that opportunity, or are you arguing that some don't?
I think everybody does.
I think everybody does.
Some form or another, I think the Holy Spirit is active all over the world and trying to help us spread the gospel.
So I've got good news. Anytime that I get Dana to be excited about speaking, we know we've said something. Dana.
So my question is, though, it's not going to get to the whole world, then why does it say that not until it is to the whole world? This gospel will be.
So where's that verse? We need, where's that reference? Is it Acts?
No. I thought
it was Matthew. Maybe it's Matthew. All right, well, let's read that verse. Well, here's my question is this. If you go back and you look at the Bible frequently excludes large sections of the planet's population. There is no talk about really the Eskimos, anybody in the Western Hemisphere. There's no talk about the Chinese. There's no talk about the Japanese. There's entire segments of the world that doesn't ever get talked about in the Bible. But I will argue that the gospel is to the whole world. And the gospel, the whole world has the opportunity to know it. The Hindus, the Taoists, the Taoists, the Buddhists, all of them have heard of Christianity. They are aware it exists.
I don't even think they have to be aware of Christianity. It says, isn't it in Romans where things of nature speak to? I mean, people know in their hearts there's something.
Right.
There's a higher power, creative being.
You're right. Paul basically says that everybody, whether they've heard of God or not, know of God and can respond to him. And that is what they are judged by. Have you found it, Ron?
I was on the other things.
Right.
Sorry.
That's fine.
Well, Paul says that the gospel is bearing fruit in all the world in Colossians.
Okay.
Which kind of suggests that even in his time, whatever he means by all the world.
People had heard about it, or at least. I do not believe that God's return is conditional upon us preaching the gospel to the whole world. I believe that it will happen. So when I read that verse, my interpretation of it is not that his return is conditional, but rather that that will be what has happened and will happen at the time of his return.
14.
It's what?
24:14 in Matthew.
Matthew 24:14 is our reference. Please read that for us.
And this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come.
So my interpretation, the way I read that, is that it's not conditional that that's what happens. It's simply a statement of fact. When Jesus returns, everybody will know about it, and the gospel will have been preached to everybody at that stage. Tim?
Well, there is a tribe in Australia that the Australian government forbids
anyone to
interact with them. How they can change the law. Sky writing? They don't read English writing in your Bible. How do you know where the dialect in the Cantonese?
Dana?
I know that there's stories in the past, many stories, where these tribes that have no interaction, that their chiefs or whatever are given dreams. And some of them will say, they'll be told that someone is coming, listen to them, and it's opened up their hearts for receiving the gospel.
Well, there must be a tribe buried deep in some cave in the Amazon that hasn't heard about God, because that's why God hasn't come back. We need to find him. Because as soon as we find them, then God gets here, and all the misery and suffering and pain that we pray for, you know, I mean, all the people who are sick and hurting, the reason they're hurting is because we haven't found that one last tribe. Tom.
Well, some of our I don't know if I should call it misunderstandings or our assumptions are based on some SOP comments about God could have come long before this if his people hadn't blah, 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 blah. So then we get started thinking about that. And so, oh, what haven't we done? What haven't we done? And then we get into the, see, it's already started. What haven't we done? So it just starts getting crazy. And we haven't been able to figure out since 1844, which everything was perfectly figured out to the end of the last prophecy. And now we're in this, we don't know what's happening stage.
I've been at that stage since the cross. All right, Robert, and then we got Mike.
Here's that guy who's going around and getting all the dark spots on the Google map and discovering what's in those dark spots that are not long. He might make some progress for us.
I hope so.
I'm not sure of his faith base, but I
hope he's not modern.
I know he's stubborn enough to figure out where all those dark spots are.
All right, Mike and then Sam.
So if you read that text chronologically, and this gospel of the kingdom will be preached in all the world as a witness to all the nations. Then Christ comes, every eye will see him. And then the end will come. So, I mean, if every eye is going to see him, yeah, okay, we know something's new up with all this. And then the end comes. So, I mean, that could be interpreted as a long time period. It could be, well, the internet allows everyone to see Christ. Or when Christ comes, then everyone will know. Then the end comes.
I think those are all fair questions. Sam.
I was on the same page with Mike. My Bible says it will spread to every nation. It doesn't talk about individuals. It talks to groups of people.
But wait, God isn't that kind of a God. He says, America knows we're okay if the people on Orcas Island don't know. That's not what God's about.
All right, so let me go back to another little story that's in the time of Christ. There were a couple of men who were demon possessed, and Jesus casts out those demons, casts them into a herd of pigs. What did the demons say when he did that?
It's not time yet.
Why? What's the exact, what, how did he phrase it? How did they phrase it exactly? The appointed time is not yet. So you're all correct. They said there is a time and it's not yet. So why are you interfering with us? What do those demons know? They know that there's a time, a specific time that is set, and it ain't yet. It wasn't at the time of Christ anyway. What are they referring to? What did they know that we don't? Now, Jesus tells us that no man knows the day and the hour. And as a result, we all say we're not going to discuss that. It's off the table. No discussion. Obviously, the guys in 1844 blew it, and we ain't going to talk about it again. It's a very, very bad thing to do. And I'm not suggesting that I can pick the year. I really don't think that's possible. At least not with my study of the calendar. Don't think that's it. But there is an appointed time. What is that appointed time? Where is the, what are the demons referring to?
In the cross, 1844. Hale-Bopp Comet.
There's been all kinds of things. I mean, there's been group after group after group who think they knew and predicted it down to the day, the week, whatever it might be.
Scott Roberts came out with another one.
Oh, did he? Oh, yeah, he's the one who said that Trump's going to get elected and then an asteroid's going to hit the Earth, right?
Amen.
Steve, I'd like to expand your analogy a little bit. You're talking about people knowing about using masks as an analogy for the gospel. Do you think instead of us waiting or God waiting or whoever is waiting until everybody hears that they need to use a mask, are we waiting until a certain number of people or a certain percentage or whatever actually use it?
So let's go with what Anna, our math professor, is talking about. If God needs to get to a certain number or a certain percentage, and then he can come, and the count is the percent, does he increase his probability by adding people to the population? So in other words, our population is exploding. We're adding the size of Mexico every year to the Earth's population. We're adding 100 million people per year to the planet, net gain. If it's a percentage, God's losing the war. If it's a specific number, God's increasing his odds big time by stacking the deck.
I think we're given an example of what it is, and I think it's Sodom and Gomorrah. If there's 50 people, if there's 10, if there's, I think it could be a small number.
Hello, Jerry. What? Glad you made it. I've got a theory, and you guys, I'll just tell you my bias so you know where I'm going and how I think. Number one, I think the entire Levitical sacrificial Mosaic system was there not to save a Jew. They were not there for any of that purpose. The Jews then were saved under the same conditions that you and I are saved, and that is obedience, pure heart, praising God, reconciling yourself with God. It's the same for them as it is for us today. That's what God has always wanted. He gave them the sacrificial system, not to get rid of their sins, but he did it so that we could today understand what that process of salvation is. It starts with the cross. It ends with us being completely forgiven and married to God. That's the end step. That is the last step in the process of salvation. Step one is the maker of the law dies. Step two is the maker of that law is actually dead, resting in the tomb. Step three is that God resurrects himself. If he wasn't resurrected, there would be no salvation, as Paul says, and obviously we're all lost. Step four is that message goes to the whole world. That is what started and really happened with Pentecost. And you notice each and every one of these steps happens on one of the festivals, which happens to be laid out in the sacrificial system. That Mosaic law lays out exactly when these events will happen. So on that fourth step was Pentecost, Festival of Weeks. That message went to the whole world. All of these happened after the cross. The next one is a warning to the world. The warning to the world is, look, the day of forgiveness is coming. Make sure that your life is reconciled with him. For us, each one of us, the day of forgiveness is when we make a decision. That decision might be when we're 10 years old. That decision might be when we're 80 years old. That decision is always made by each and every one of us. But at the end of time, everybody makes a decision. We all make that decision sometime during our life, whether I happen to live in 1844, whether I live in the year 2000, whether I live in the year 1901, I make a decision. Do I accept Jesus in my heart? That's step five. Step five is, get ready. The day of forgiveness is coming. Make sure your life is right with God. It's quite simple, as Robert tells me. It's simple. There's nothing complicated about this. Step six, the day of forgiveness arrives. That is the day of atonement. And that day of atonement is the day in which God wipes the sins from the book. It is the day in which he says, you and what you've done, the fruits of your spirit are good, and I accept you as a part of the system, as a part of the universe, as a part of me. Step seven. According to the sacrificial system. Step seven is time in the wilderness. Why is there a time in the wilderness after the day of forgiveness? There is a time of testing. There is a time of doubt. The time that the Jews spent 40 years in the wilderness happens after the day of forgiveness.
of Revelation talks about 1260 days, 3.5 years, 42 months, time in the wilderness. That happens after the day of forgiveness. According to the sacrificial system, that's what it's telling you. Step 8. Bible only has step 7, right? No, there's a step 8. Step 8 is what? Step 8 is reconciliation of man and God. It is the marriage of man and God. Step 8 is the purification of the altar. It is the purification of humanity. It is the twinkling of the eye. It is when we are reconciled completely with God. That sounds a little bit strange, and I know that doesn't quite reconcile with what we've always heard. That is my opinion, what the sacrificial system says. It begins at the cross. It doesn't end there. It begins there, and each one of these steps is God's plan of bringing humanity and Godhead together and reconciling man and God and eliminating and eradicating evil forever. That's where I am going with it. And I think the times are appointed according to the demons, quoting demons. The appointed time has not yet come. Why are you interfering with this? Why are you messing with this? The appointed times are the festivals, and those festivals tell us when each of these events happen. We don't know which year they will meet their greatest fulfillment, but for each one of us, many of us will never make it to the second coming. For us, the day of shouts, get ready, atonement is coming, forgiveness is coming. The day of judgment happens for each and every one of us, even if we don't make it to the second coming. For us, that might be today. For us, it might be next year. Who knows? But the message is the same. But for one generation, the real, actual fulfillment will be there, and it's important. That's where I'm going with it. That's what I believe. Mike.
So maybe the demons were just in sales. So they're saying, hey, the time's not come. But well, if the time hadn't been come, Jesus still sent them to the swine, and they did suicide off the cliff. And so in Jesus' opinion, his time had come.
He's not the only one. The demons are not the only ones. Second, when Jesus came down, or angels came down and collected the body of Moses, there was a punishment. Time wasn't come yet, and yet God took Moses. God seems to break the rules every once in a while, at least according to what Satan thinks it should be. That's okay. Anyway, the whole point of the thing is, I believe the cross is the beginning, not the end. And that entire sacrificial system was built not for the Jews, but for us to understand. And that God has always wanted the same sacrifice. He wants our heart. He wanted it for them, and he wants it for us. The blood of the lambs and the bulls and the goats never saved anybody. They never saved the Jews. They don't save us. The only difference is, when Christ came, he paid the price. He didn't abolish that old system. He simply paid the price as required and started it, and that's why we should still look at it.
But why can't I get it here?
I think your time is probably about now, isn't it? I should get out of here.
Not necessarily.
Thank you, sir.
Hello, Joanne.